I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Alan Blinder says that a perfect storm created the financial crisis that began in 2007. A housing and bond bubble that burst, a financial system that had grown too complex and too risky, plus a lack of government oversight and regulation. Blinder was vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors back in the 90s, served on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, and is currently a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book, After the Music Stopped, offers a history of the financial crisis and a prescription for reform. He says TARP and the stimulus, though not perfect, mostly worked. The problem, he writes, is that the Bush and particularly Obama administrations did a poor job of communicating with the public about what they were doing and why. Alan Blinder joins us by telephone, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, nice to be here, Marty. Thank you.
One of the things that you say is part of our problem is that people forget about what happened back in 3-4 years ago. So with that in mind, take us back to 2009, 4 years ago. In fact, you say in your book that February, March were the darkest days. Just how dark were those days?
They were pretty dark. If you recall the timing, Lehman Brothers had failed messily in the middle of September 2008, and the economy just sort of fell off the table. The TARP was enacted about two and a half weeks after that, put into effect pretty quickly. But that was almost it. It was the waning days of the Bush administration. Then we had the transition to the Obama administration in January 2009. Things had deteriorated since September, and I would say the month sort of January, February, maybe into March. Certainly if you date it by the stock market, it was March, but that's not the only way to date it, were the darkest days. And there was serious talk of the financial system really imploding with horrific effects. And related to that, there were serious talks in modern parlance of Great Depression 2.0.
So with that being said, does the Obama administration deserve some credit for where we sit today, as imperfect as it is?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. Imperfect as it is, but they absolutely do deserve some credit. I think without the stimulus, without continuing the TARP, which of course was a Bush administration policy, and without the third member, the almost unknown member of the big triumvirate, which was the stress test done on major banking institutions in the spring of 2009, after which people started feeling it was safe to deal with these institutions again. Without those three, we would have had a vastly worse outcome. A paper a couple of years ago by Mark Zandi and I tried to estimate this using an economic model, and we estimated unemployment might have gotten up to the 16-17% range, which is, you know, something we haven't seen since the 30s.
But you write something, and this is a kind of a paradox, I guess, of the recovery. And I'm quoting you here: government rushed in to save the day, yet government emerged as the villain. How did that happen?
Well, that is a really good question. That's one of the central things that I try to explore in the book. I think it was a combination of things, one of which you already mentioned, which is when you, the government, and here I include the Federal Reserve, but mostly the elected government, those the Bush administration, the Obama administration, need to do a lot of things that are, first of all, inherently politically unpopular, like bailing out banks. And even beyond that are counterintuitive, like people were asking, why are we giving money to the very people that got us into this mess? The communications burden is huge. Huge. You're never going to win, in the sense you're never going to make this politically unpopular. But, you know, to my way of thinking, there are degrees of unpopularity. And with better and more persistent communications, repeating and explaining over and over again, I think we would have done better. The other big thing, Marty, in terms of unpopularity is that the stimulus, of course, ballooned the deficit for very good reasons. This was not a silly, spurious increase in the deficit for no reason other than politics, say. But it was in order to save the economy, which was very, very short on demand. So somebody had to do spending, and the government is the the most plausible candidate in such emergencies. But Americans have always hated budget deficits, always. And they looked at these deficits, and that was one of the things that gave seed corn to the Tea Party, as you may remember.
But it's interesting because a lot of people have a lot of personal debt, but there's something offensive about government debt?
Yeah, you know, somehow they don't score it the same way. A lot of households, when you count their mortgages in particular, have debt that's several times their annual income, or at least their annual income, or more than their annual income. And it's not considered strange or irresponsible or anything like that, as long as they have the wherewithal to pay it back. But people want, you hear it all the time, people want to balance the national budget, which means the debt stops growing. You don't add any more debt, period, which isn't really a sensible criterion in a growing economy. You know, we have a bigger nation year after year after year. We can afford more debt, though in limits. You know, you don't want to borrow limitlessly.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, but let me just pick up on a couple of things, including TARP, because you are critical of then-Secretary of the Treasury Paulson. The original TARP bill was 3 pages long, and you described it as a kind of an assault on the Constitution.
Well, I think it was. It was an abomination. They corrected it pretty quickly, but it said, among other things, that, first of all, it gave the Secretary of the Treasury unrestricted, completely unrestricted authority to dispose of $700 billion as he sees fit. That seems a stretch already. But the most important thing in terms of constitutionality, I was stunned when this came out of the Treasury, was there was a clause in there. Mind you, the whole thing was 2.5 pages long.
Right.
But there was a clause in there that said the Secretary's treasuries are not subject to judicial or administrative review.
Wow.
I looked at that and I said, what? What have happened to checks and balances? What is beyond judicial review in this country? I just didn't see how, I don't understand to this day how the people at the Treasury thought they could square that with the Constitution.
But that's,
and of course, it didn't pass that way.
Exactly. But do you think the government should have imposed, what, tougher conditions on banks that got this money?
Yes. I think, first of all, Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, was warned by several politicians, prominently Barney Frank, but others as well, that when you're asking the public to pony up this kind of money, you better put sharp restrictions on executive pay. And he put only very minimalist restrictions on executive pay. Secondly, he did not stop banks from paying dividends.
Right.
So you could have this image that the government's shoveling money into banks, the banks shoveling it to the shareholders. That wasn't true to a great extent, but it was true to some extent, and a very bad thing for the reputation of the TARP. And thirdly, contrary to what I thought they should have done at the time, they put no lending requirements on the banks. So as a quid pro quo for getting this public money, you ought to at least maintain your lending or increase your lending a little bit. Now, that is not the sort of thing we would ever want to do to banks in normal times when they're operating with their own money, their own capital. You know, these are business decisions bankers made. But when they're operating with publicly provided capital, I think the public has a right to some public purpose use of the money, and there was basically none required.
But you also say, and perhaps the public doesn't know this, is that TARP has been largely paid back.
More than paid back. In fact, if you look just at the parts we're talking about, the financial parts, the capital that went to the banks and anything else that's financial, TARP has turned a profit already with still some monies to come back.
Mm-hmm.
The only losses left in TARP, you may remember just within the last month, I think, AIG paid back, which amazed a lot of people if you think back to the likelihood that would have happened, circa 2008. The only losses that remain in the TARP's portfolio basically come from the automobile bailout from Chrysler and General Motors. And while they're smaller than a lot of people thought at the time, it doesn't look likely that we'll get all that money back.
Do you think more people should have gone to prison? In fact, you identify a guy named Lee Farkas as the only person that's actually gone to prison as a result of this financial crisis.
Yes.
Do you think more people should be behind bars?
I do. I mean, I can't name names because jailing for fraud is a high bar. It's a high level of proof, as you know, compared to a civil suit, and you have to prove intent and so on. So it's not like everybody let's put it this way. We don't want to jail people for stupidity. Hmm. That's not an appropriate remedy. But it's hard for me to believe that in the biggest financial, in the lead up to the biggest financial ructions that we've seen in this country since the 1930s, hardly anybody, a handful of people. Farkas was the most high ranked, but it's a trivial number of people that were jailed for fraud or even tried for fraud, for that matter. The government did lose a few cases. Compare that to the savings and loan debacle in the late 80s and early 90s, which was a smaller problem, to be sure, and yet 700, 800, 900 people wound up in jail for fraud.
So do you think the Obama administration should have brought more charges or hauled more people into court?
Absolutely. Again, not to trump up charges against people that hadn't committed fraud, but to prosecute things that really looked like fraud. I think this is one on a long list of reasons of the factors that made the public so angry. I mean, the whole thing looked like a giant cheating scandal to the public. Now, not all of it was, but nonetheless, it had that appearance, and some of it was. And yet they look around and say, let's see, I've lost my job, my neighbor's lost his house, and nobody's gone to jail for any of this.
One of the things, and I've said this in the past, and I might have even said it to you in a previous interview, is a concern. You just wonder just how grateful were these bankers and these banking institutions for what the government and what the government did with public money to help them out.
Yeah, now it varied, but my general impression is not grateful enough. You didn't hear a lot of apologies from the banking and especially investment banking industry, as I mentioned in the book, probably on advice of their lawyers.
Right.
They suggest they did something wrong. You heard some gratitude from some quarters for the money, but not a lot. And then, of course, what we saw and are still seeing to a very large extent is fighting tooth and nail against every regulatory innovation proposed or actually enacted. The fighting doesn't stop after enactment because you still have the writing of detailed regulations and the enforcement of them and so on. I mean, the industry has just been pushing back practically from day one, before day one, against the financial reforms enacted in 2010.
Well, let's take a very short break. I want to pick up on that. A quick reintroduction here. Alan Blinder is our guest today on Radio Times, author of a new book called After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and the Work Ahead. And he's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. And we are talking about the financial crisis, TARP, the stimulus, the bailout. And he's got some ideas for reforms as well, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday morning, February 6th from 9 to 11 a.m. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Registration now open for summer reading and writing program.
I'm Marty Moscowen. It's the sixth day of the winter membership drive here at WHYY, and we're asking for your pledge of support. We thank the thousands of you who have contributed to our news and information service over the years. You can hear your investment on the air in the programs that you enjoy. If you haven't become a member yet, do it now and call 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, an hour's discussion of the financial financial crisis and what can be done to reform the system and get people back to work. Our guest is Princeton University's Alan Blinder, author of After the Music Stop. Then another hour's discussion with evolutionary anthropologist Brian Hare on his groundbreaking research on dogs and intelligence. Where else can you hear that kind of in-depth, diverse interview? Only on Radio Times at WHYY. Make a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Alan Blinder. He's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. We're talking about his new book called After the Music Stop, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Alan Blinder, did the stimulus work, the stimulus of 4 years ago?
The stimulus did work. Now, you shouldn't expect miracles from an economy may be going into a hole to the extent of 10-12% of GDP relative to where we should be, from a stimulus that's 5% of GDP. In some sense, it was less than half the size that we needed. But I think, you know, there are critics that say it should have been much larger. I think that President Obama and his team pretty much pushed the political limit in terms of what they could get through the Congress. Stimulating the economy to create jobs in the way that was done, what I like to call build it and they will come, that is build a bigger GDP and jobs will come, works, but it's expensive for a very simple arithmetical reason, which is the amount of GDP in a rich country like ours per job is quite large, around $112,000 per job. So you've got to think that roughly an average garden variety stimulus program will cost around $112,000 per job created. And if you say that to people, that sounds awfully expensive.
It sure does. But again, you say the Obama administration and perhaps even the president himself failed to communicate, educate, and convince people about what the stimulus was and how and why it worked the way it did.
Yeah, I think it's a shame. I mean, one of the minor casualties, I mean, the intellectual part of this doesn't matter except to intellectuals, but the public policy implications are severe. One of the minor casualties of this was the whole idea of Keynesian economics. Right. You see even now, I see in the media even now, members of Congress and others talking about, in the current context of the sequester, that if we spend less, if the government spends less via sequester or anything else, that's actually going to boost employment. And I scratched my head and I said, how in the world is that supposed to happen? This is completely the opposite of what we've been teaching economics students since Keynes in the late 1930s.
But can't we just look at Spain and some other countries in Europe who are England that are using austerity and see how their economy is doing?
Absolutely. And we know the answer is very poorly. The British were doing better until they came in with the austerity program. Look, there are some countries that have no choice. Greece cannot borrow anymore, so it has to have fiscal austerity. You only have the freedom of action if you're able to borrow. The United States, of course, could borrow huge amounts, and we are. We could borrow more. The British could borrow more. They still have pretty low interest rates. But this forced Fed austerity diet has, you know, basically caused the second mini recession in most of Europe.
Well, and even I'm looking at something in the New York Times today, looking at there was a slight decline, I guess, in, I don't know if it's GDP or the economy, but they said in large because of reduction by Pentagon spending and military contractors. And this is anticipation of sequester. So we need government to spend money, including the Pentagon?
I'm afraid we do. Now, look, If you think the Pentagon is already spending too much money, you might spend it elsewhere. So the basic principles behind government stimulation of a weak economy don't say you should spend it on defense or roads or food stamps or anything like that. They just say that when the private sector is not spending enough, so this is businesses and the consumer, to employ the full labor force, the government has a role to step in and spend in some way. Or, by the way, to cut people's taxes. It doesn't all have to be spending, but something to boost demand.
So if there should be more government spending, what should it be spent on? What would get the best return for that investment?
Yeah, well, right now, if I were given a hypothetical magic wand to wave, and I think, by the way, that's the only way to get things through Congress.
It certainly feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. I would be targeting any additional spending very sharply on jobs so that we didn't have to spend $112,000, $115,000 per job. So a couple of things I have in mind. One is direct public employment, school teachers, teachers' aides, people working in the parks, people working on highway repair, et cetera, et cetera. Realistically, the way we structure government in America, that would be mostly state and local, not federal employment, but paid for by the federal government. You can create jobs at a much cheaper cost per job that way. The other thing that I've been advocating for years, and so have others, and by the way, the Obama administration has pushed this on a small scale as well, is a tax credit to businesses that will increment their payrolls. That is no reward just for maintaining the number of employees you have, but if you will increment the number of employees you have, you get a tax break.
And is the private sector not spending because there isn't consumer demand, or they'd rather have the government do it, or they'd rather sit on the sidelines and see what's going to happen with the economy?
I think for the consumer, this sounds like circular reasoning, and in a sense, I realize it sounds that way, but it's not. For the consumer, it's mainly that the economic engine's not churning enough so that their incomes are not growing rapidly enough. If you look at recent consumer behavior, consumer spending is growing in concert with consumer incomes, more or less. So the consumer is not a big driver, as was the case in the boom years, but it's not really a big retardant. What's been retarding the economy recently? One, housing, which is finally coming back. Housing is now, in 2013, I think, going to be a helpful driver towards faster economic growth. But in most of 2012, and certainly in 2011 and 2010, it was like an anchor pulling us down. And the other thing, ironically, is government spending. Despite all this fuss about budget deficits, after the stimulus peaked in 2010 or so, government spending has been going, in most quarters, with a few aberrations, down, down, down. Mm. And the last quarter that you referred to was a whopper. An incredibly large drop in government spending in general, and especially defense spending, some of which was just making up for the boom in defense spending the previous quarter. When that came out in the data, a lot of us scratched our heads, say, what is going on here? That doesn't seem right. So if you average between the third and fourth quarters, I think you get a clearer picture.
And I do want to get to our callers, but in terms of government spending, does it make sense to spend on things like roads and bridges and all the infrastructure that we know that's crumbling across this country?
I think it very much does, for exactly the reason you just said. Keynes, in frustration back in the 30s, quipped that if we couldn't spend the government wouldn't spend money on anything sensible. They should just bury currency in glass bottles around the country and pay people to dig it up. We can do better than that. We can build roads. We can repair roads, bridges, tunnels. We all know, no matter what town or city we live in, that American infrastructure, public infrastructure, is really not up to snuff. Mm-hmm. You only have to go abroad and look what countries at, two-thirds to one-half of our living standards actually have in public infrastructure. So the needs are there. The benefits of better infrastructure are clear. And that would be a very sensible thing to spend money on.
And that's Alan Blinder, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a new book called After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and the Work Ahead. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Alan Blinder, let's get a couple of callers in. We have, it looks like, Ken from Abington joining us on Radio Times. And Ken, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'd like the guest to describe the impact of the over-leveraging, mainly on credit default swaps, but other instruments where, for lack of better words, the insurance companies like AIG were betting three times, having people insured that 30 times higher than the actual base of the asset. And what did that contribute to how fast the meltdown, how severe the meltdown was? And also, is that still a risk today, not only with just more assets, but other debt instruments like credit card securitizations and things like that?
Ken, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Alan Blinder, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and the answer is yes. But let me elaborate on the answer. When I was talking to you, Marty, we sort of started the story in 2009. But if you look back and ask, how did we ever get into such a mess? Excessive leverage, too much borrowing, was a central, if not indeed the central, ingredient in the house of cards that was first built up and then crumbled. It started with families taking on mortgage debts that they couldn't afford. It then went to banks that let their balance sheets get too leveraged. It then especially went to investment banks, which I think your caller was referring to when he talked about 30-to-1. You did have some of these investment banks with 30-to-1 leverage. Mm-hmm. What does that mean in plain English? That means if you lose 3 1/3% of your asset value, suppose you've invested in some bad mortgages, and that adds up to 3 1/3% of the total assets you have, you're bankrupt because it blows up 30-to-1 with leverage, and that indeed happened. So, yes, it had to do with the speed of the collapse. It had to do with the ferocity of the collapse. And the last part of the question is, are we at risk for something like that today? The answer is yes, but substantially less than we were. Two main reasons for that. One is the sort of once burned, twice shy principle, which works for a while, not forever. These companies were burned badly, the survivors, and most did survive. They haven't yet forgotten that lesson, and they are considerably less leveraged than they were before. Another way to put the same point, since leverage is about how much you borrow versus your own capital, right, is they have more capital. They're better capitalized than they were before. So the system is safer in that regard. What about the future? As you look forward, there are requirements on many institutions, certainly including the banks, to keep higher levels of capital in the future, higher minimum levels of capital. I'm talking now about legal requirements rather than judgments made by business people. Higher legal levels of capital than was true before the crisis. Those laws will endure. Well, we need to make sure those laws endure and they don't get repealed later on.
Ken, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Does that raise the question about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that seems to have been under attack since its creation?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a different issue because I was speaking about bank capital, but
yes,
it's completely analogous that this was a very important reform put into place by the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. The Republicans, as you know, opposed it pretty much to the man and woman with no exceptions. They have refused to confirm anybody for the job, which is why Elizabeth Warren is now a senator from Massachusetts instead of running the agency, and why Richard Cordray, who is running the agency, had to get in by recess appointment by the president. And the Republicans keep on trying to weaken it. It was set up in the law quite deliberately not to have to go to Congress year after year for an appropriation, because the proponents of the Consumer Protection Bureau, who feared, quite correctly, I think, that people on the other side would just defund it. Mm-hmm. You defund an agency, it can still exist, but it can't do anything. It has to lay off workers and can't do investigations, and so on. So it was set up with its own source of funding, independent of the appropriations process, and a leader, a director. And many Republicans, right to this day, this is current right now, want to change both of those aspects of the agency.
And this is an agency whose job is to protect consumers against financial fraud and abuse.
Absolutely. And what you added there, and abuse, is really important. As we were saying before, fraud may be hard to prove and is probably the exception rather than the rule. But there's an awful lot of abuse an awful lot of people led down primrose paths into financial contracts they don't understand and never should be signing. And it's the main mission of the Bureau, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, to make things intelligible to consumers so that they're not duped in this way.
To protect from those predatory lenders?
Yes, exactly that. Exactly that. And they're doing that. I think, you know, this agency is off to a good start, I think.
Let me get Wayne from Lancaster to join us, Lancaster County, I should say. Wayne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Always an insightful show.
Thank you.
Very educational.
Thank you.
I was curious on his hearing his views on it seems like over the years the banks have taken more and more money out of the economy and out of the lending area and put it into their own investments and speculative investing in commodities, heating oil, things of that nature, which hurts the consumer in the end because we're all end users. I'm just curious to hear his comments on that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Wayne. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Alan Blinder, go ahead.
Well, thank you. You are very much correct on the prelude to the crisis, the lead up to the crisis. You had a lot of monies going into more speculative activities. Now, ironically, a lot of these things were securities based on mortgages. So, of course, making mortgages is a standard part of banking and has been for as long as we've had banks, practically. So ironically, but this was done through securities and things like that, some of which were quite speculative. And then there was a miscellany of other stuff. Right now, because of the memory lingering on, as I was saying a few moments ago, I don't think this is a big problem. The question is, what will happen once the dust clears and the memories get foggy and the world looks safe again? Nobody knows for sure, and that's the reason why, for example, Paul Volcker pushed for and got into the Dodd-Frank legislation, the so-called Volcker rule, to keep banks out, insured banks, banks that have FDIC insurance, regular banks, out of the what's called proprietary trading, that is betting on things for profit or loss for their own account. Ironically, the much bigger problem now is not that, but the fact that fearful banks are hoarding cash. It's as if you and I just had tons and tons of money in our checking accounts doing nothing. We weren't spending it, we weren't lending it, we weren't investing it, we weren't doing anything with it. And if you look around the American banking system, which used to have essentially zero in these idle, they're called reserves at the Federal Reserve, bank accounts that they hold at the Federal Reserve. The total volume prior to the crisis in those things was very close to zero because you couldn't make any money on them. Now it's $1.6 trillion. That's
wow.
Trillion with a T.
Wow.
We've never seen anything like this. And it's one of the things that is stopping lending from coming back.
Well, I want to pick up on that because I think that leads us into something that you're calling for, negative interest rates. I hope I have that right. I'm showing my ignorance about our financial system, but I'm also talking with Alan Blinder. He's got a new book called After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and the Work Ahead. And he was a vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. This was back in the 1990s. He served on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, and he's currently a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Art and Theater Company presents Nobel Prize winner Samuel Beckett's Endgame, now on stage through March 10th. Ham can't stand up. Clove can't sit down. Neither can leave the single room they've shared for who knows how long. For them, the end is in the beginning. Beckett's writing in the space between vaudeville and Pinter, Chaplin and Stoppard shows us that nothing is funnier than unhappiness. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or online at artandtheater.org.
I'm Marty Moscoen. We're in the middle of the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we hope to end the drive by the end of the week. We will only do that with your pledge of support. If your membership has lapsed, if you're new to the area, perhaps you're new to WHYY and public broadcasting, take that next step and make a pledge of support. You decide what this service is worth and then call 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. You can get a special Radio Times anniversary mug designed by our very own award-winning Tony Auth for just a pledge of $60. We host 500 hour-long interviews every year on Radio Times, something for everyone. Today we're talking about the roots of the financial crisis with Princeton University's Alan Blinder and about dogs' intelligence with evolutionary anthropologist Brian Hare. Where else do you hear those kinds of interviews? Make a pledge, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks so much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. 4 years ago, the country was hemorrhaging jobs. The new Obama administration was putting together a stimulus plan. Our guest Alan Blinder says, ironically, the stimulus largely worked, but the administration did a poor job explaining it and selling it to the country, and that has made it harder to argue for more government spending, which Blinder says would help create more jobs. He's the author of a new book we've been talking about, After the Music Stopped, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So, Alan Blinder, how would a negative interest rate work, and how would that get banks to start, spending some money?
So here's the basic problem that the Federal Reserve has had since the end of 2008. The main interest rate it usually controls to try to slow down or speed up the economy is called the federal funds rate. And it's been, it can't go below zero, and it's been hovering just above zero since then. So this is more than 4 years already. The Fed has had to turn to other things. There is one interest rate that could actually go negative, and that is the interest rate that the Fed pays banks to hold these idle reserves I was speaking about before the break. This is exactly analogous to your own and my own checking accounts. Now, I don't know what you're getting paid, but my bank pays me 1 basis point for my checking balance. That's 1/100th of a percent. The Federal Reserve pays banks 25 times that. Now, you don't get rich on that. That
No.
is not a lot of money.
No.
But the Fed could take that and at least as a first step drop it to zero, where it was for most of the history of the Federal Reserve. And then it can go negative, turn it into a storage fee. If you want to keep money here, we're going to charge you for the storage privileges. I believe doing that would sandblast quite a bit of the $1.6 trillion of idle money out of those checking accounts the banks hold at the Federal Reserve, and into something else, anything else, you know, into the capital markets. And I think some of it would go into bank lending. Certainly not the whole $1.6 trillion or anything remotely close to that. But, you know, every little bit would help. And the $1.6 trillion just sitting there in a pile, an electronic pile, to be sure, isn't doing anybody any good.
Let me get some more callers in. Looks like we have Dario from Center City, Philadelphia. Dario, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, a very interesting show as usual.
Thank you. Whoops, I think we lost Dario. And I'll relay his question to you, Alan Blinder,
okay,
wanting to know about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, whether that was good or bad for the economy. Is there an answer to that?
Well, there's not a full answer because it certainly benefited some sectors that provides war material and so on. But I think it was mostly bad, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. I was speaking earlier about there being a persuasive rationale for the huge increase in the deficit that came early in the Obama administration. It had to do with the weakening of the economy, of course, which kills off tax revenue, and it had to do with the need to spend our way out of the problem. If you look back at the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, just as economic propositions, never mind the human toll, which, of course, is the more important one, but just sticking to the economics, President Bush made twice the fateful decision to put these on the national credit card, that is, to just finance them by debt. The history of warfare in our country and every other country you can think of is that taxes go up to pay for wars. And maybe other types of government spending go down, but mostly taxes go up to spend to pay for wars. President Bush decided not to do that. So the result of that and doing the same with the Medicare drug benefit when that was enacted into law under President Bush was that the federal deficit went up from a number like 200 to 250 surplus left by Bill Clinton to about a $450 billion per year deficit left by George Bush before, and this is the key thing, before the economy started sinking like a rock. It would have been much better if we could have still had the $250 billion surplus when the economy started sinking like a rock. Now, that $450 went up to about $1.4 trillion. So the deficit went up by almost a trillion. But wouldn't it have been a lot better if that same trillion increase had started from a base of a surplus of $750 in the black, so we only wound up, so we only wound up $750 in the red instead of $1.4 trillion. In the red.
But do you think Americans, most Americans should be paying more taxes?
Yeah, I'm afraid to say so. I'm afraid I have to say so. Now, I don't run for office, so if I was running
you
for office...
You can say these things, yes.
I'd probably be fumfering like mad over your question. But the sad truth is that given the aging of the population and other demands on the budget... If we're going to get, never mind to a balanced budget, just to a modest deficit, which we can well afford, we're going to need some more revenue. And the Republicans are right to say you can't get it all out of the top earners. Now, I think we could get a little more out of the top earners, but we're not going to get it all out of the top earners. So I think that everybody is going to have to pay a little bit more. And you know, it actually started this January with the rescission of the 2% cut in the payroll tax. So every working American is now paying a bit more in taxes than he or she was in December.
But does that not then hurt the economy? If we depend on consumer spending, if people have less money, chances are they're going to spend less.
It absolutely does. And that's exactly the reason why I and many other economists, Republicans and Democrats alike, by the way, have been saying for years that we don't want to rush into deficit reduction. So deficit reduction could either mean cutting spending or raising taxes. We need to go to deficit reduction over the longer term. But while the economy remains weak, we don't want to do too much of that. It's not smart to do too much of that. That's the austerity issue that you asked about earlier, Marty. The Europeans are showing us that it's not a very smart thing to do.
Let me get Joe from Macungie, Pennsylvania, to join us. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're very
welcome. Can you
hear me? Yes, indeed. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, I just wanted to correct one thing that Mr. Blinder said when he compared the federal debt to individual debt, and individuals are okay with their own debt, and use mortgages as an example. The beauty of mortgages is you're paying interest and principal every year, and it goes down over a period of time. They're gone. Federal debt keeps growing every year. The other point I want to make is I think there's a simple solution to the federal debt, and nobody likes it, but simply default, and it forces the federal government to live within its own means. And I'll take the comments off the air. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Joe. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Are you in favor of default?
I'm definitely not in favor of default. I mean, default, it will open a whole Pandora's box that we can barely understand or predict. One thing we do know is it will make forever the borrowing costs of the United States higher than they otherwise would be. Now, remember, even if we go to no more debt issued, we've got a lot of debt out there that need, and a lot of it rolls over frequently because it's short term and we have to refinance it. Even if we don't run another penny of deficits from this day forward. In addition to that, that would put into question the creditworthiness of the United States government, even in ordinary transactions, contracts with, you know, defense contractors, people that sell goods and services to the government. This is exactly the reason why a lot of us economists are very fearful of coming close to a debt ceiling crisis, which might cause people to worry about the full faith and credit of the United States. You know, Alexander Hamilton started us off on the right track at the beginning of the Republic, making sure that nobody would look at this fledgling country as a deadbeat country, and we've honored that up to now. So I couldn't be more against default.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Alan Blinder, are you concerned about this growing income divide? It seems like there are more very wealthy people in this country, more poor people in this country. The poverty rate has gone up. And of course, we know about middle class people who are struggling in the middle. What can we do about poverty? We've had this so-called war on poverty for decades now.
Yeah, I am very concerned about it. It, you know, this is one where your underlying political philosophy really comes to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
It is very hard to get conservative people at all worked up about this. They take the attitude, well, you know, that's what the market is dishing out, c'est la vie. I don't agree with that for two reasons. First of all, the government over the last 30 years has been doing more to actually worsen income inequalities than to narrow them. And what am I referring to? I'm referring to the Reagan tax cuts back in the early 80s, the Bush tax cuts in the early 2000s, that despite the fact that the market was turning against less skilled people, actually cut the taxes much more for upper-income people than for lower-income people, thereby making a problem that it did not create. Ronald Reagan did not create this problem. George Bush did not create this problem. The markets did this. But the government made it worse, and I think that was a mistake. Secondly, even if that hadn't happened, and this is where you come to your underlying political philosophy, to me, and this is a personal view but shared by many, it's not the kind of society that we should be living in, where we have this extreme wealth at the top with people buying and enjoying things that are extravagant. At the same time that other people in a rich country, a country that's rich on average, are struggling to meet ends meet and in many cases aren't making ends meet. You hear a lot about entitlement reform. But the truth is that being poor in America is pretty – America is a pretty bad place to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be poor, you do better in France, in Germany, in England, in Sweden, and so on. America is a great place to be rich. But, you know, that's not everybody.
And the idea is what there isn't the kind of safety net that you see in some other countries, for instance?
We have the kind of safety net, but
right. It's
not nearly as generous. Not nearly as generous. So people really can fall into very deep holes. And some people aren't really collecting. You know, another thing you have to do is a little bit of outreach to people that may not be quite up on what's going on, may not be quite literate, maybe disconnected, maybe that's more important, disconnected from the rest of society. So some people don't even get the benefits they're entitled to. But secondly, those benefits, these things that get decried as excessive welfare, are really in the United States pretty stingy compared to Europe.
And looking ahead, does it make sense then to invest in education to get people the kinds of skills that they're going to need for a future, even more complex economy?
It absolutely makes sense. Now, it's not so easy to do, right? We in the United States have been talking about this problem for more than a generation. It's still with us. You do see pockets of fantastic progress, some really excellent schools developed in poor areas that really do give a hand up to the students, to the youngsters in those school systems. Now, that takes a generation, of course, to improve things, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that we're still in the infancy, really, of understanding what are the things that actually work, what are the things that don't work, and funding the things that work and not funding the things that don't work. We got to keep working at that.
And that's Alan Blinder, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new book called After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Alan Blinder, you talk about the fact that we shouldn't think austerity today, but looking ahead to future of healthcare costs, especially with all these aging and retiring baby boomers, is that the big challenge that the country faces looking ahead, trying to figure out how to pay for healthcare in this country?
In fact, if you look far ahead, it depends how far you mean looking ahead, but if you start looking beyond the next decade to the next 20, 30, 40 years, it is the budget challenge in the sense that if we can somehow solve that problem, and nobody quite knows how, we won't have a budget deficit problem any longer. And if we can't, we're going to have a budget deficit problem that gets worse and worse and worse. So it's sort of that simple over the long run, or that simple and that complex. It would be great if we knew, okay, here are the three things we have to do, and that will control the growth of the healthcare dragon. We don't. I think the Obamacare bill in 2009 took a relatively intelligent approach to that, which is to enact on either a small scale or experimental or trial basis almost every idea, that's ever been suggested for cost containment. And let's see what works. That takes some time because, as you know, the whole bill isn't really effective until 2014. So it's going to be 2014 plus several years before we actually have a good grip on what worked and what didn't work. And there is always the danger that none of these things work, in which case it will be back to the drawing board. But I'm hopeful that at least some will work. Look, we do know that other countries have better healthcare outcomes spending vastly less than us. So it's not like we're trying to do alchemy and turn lead into gold. These things have been done in other countries.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Unfair question to end the hour, but do you think we have a political system that's up to the task to fix some of the things that we've been talking about today on the show?
In a word, no. It's a shame, I think, what's going on with our political system. We used to have a much more vibrant and at least sometimes cooperative two-party system. If you look at the history of big, big changes in the government, entitlements and other things, they were bipartisan. Big, big financial reforms were bipartisan. Now everything is just bitterly partisan, and Congress is more often tied up in knots than doing anything. We have a big agenda in political reform, I'm afraid.
Well, Alan Blinder, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. He's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University and, again, author of a book we've been talking about called After the Music Stopped. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, the archive, Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.